It's not uncommon for writers to have day jobs. There are lawyers who write, soldiers who write, teachers who write, and the list of doctors who write is long and impressive. Anton Chekhov, William Carlos Williams, Walker Percy, Somerset Maugham, Arthur Conan Doyle, to name just a few from the past. NPR's Lynn Neary was curious about the connection between medicine and literature, and she spoke with two doctors whose books were recently published.
For Abraham Verghese, writing and medicine are inextricably entwined. Verghese's first book, My Own Country, was a memoir based on his experience as a doctor treating AIDS patients in rural Tennessee. His latest book and first novel, Cutting for Stone, is the story of a family of doctors, a saga that takes the readers into hospitals and operating rooms from Ethiopia to America.
Well, I think I came to medicine with a strong sense of medicine being a romantic pursuit, a calling. And I'm still really very much in love with medicine, and I love what I do. And I often think that the writing emanates from that stance of being a physician. And I worry that I would become mute if I ever left medicine and tried to write.
Terence Holt comes from a family of doctors, but he was a writer and a teacher long before he decided to go to medical school. His new book of stories, In the Valley of the Kings, reflects his fascination with language rather than his life as a physician. Being comfortable in the world of literature, Holt says, is enormously helpful in the practice of medicine.
You're used to dealing with ambiguities, if you're familiar with literature, and a lot of medicine is ambiguous. But I think maybe the most important thing is that you get vicariously, but I think in a very useful way, experience with other people that you couldn't get any other way, with seeing the world as other people see it.
Now a specialist in geriatrics, Holt is on the faculty in the School of Medicine at the University of North Carolina. One recent morning, he went on rounds with a group of residents and interns.
Mr. S., he's our 16-year-old guy, history of alcohol and marijuana abuse, presenting from Trosa with altered mental status, found to have MRI findings suggestive of Marcus Vava Bignami. And
patients bring us stories. We drop into the middle of patients' stories and try to change the plot for the better. First, we have to try to understand it, however. I mean, the first thing that happens when a patient comes in is they start telling a story and you try to figure out what it means.
He was a little bit more spastic this morning than I've seen him. He was having some pretty significant clonus of his upper extremities, and I hadn't seen that before. And I asked him if that was usual for him, and he says that happens fairly frequently. He says it particularly happens when he's around women. He says he gets a little nervous and starts shaking when he's
there. Abraham Verghese also says a patient's history is like a story. If you listen carefully, he says, you will hear the clues needed to make a diagnosis.
I'm always struck that when I'm called in as a consultant, it's very rare that some extra piece of knowledge tucked away in my brain solves the puzzle. Much more often, it's the fact that the story I'm hearing resonates with my collection of stories, or there's an element in that story that reminds me of something in my catalog of stories, and I go seek out the other elements. So I think narrative is huge in medicine.
In Cutting for Stone, Verghese set out to create an epic story that encompasses family, politics, history, and love, all set against the backdrop of life in and near hospitals. He spares no details in his descriptions of often complex medical procedures and the human emotions that surround them. Verghese says he wanted to reveal the inner workings of the world of medicine.
You come to a hospital, especially as a patient, and all of a sudden you're in this crucible where every human emotion, every passion is exaggerated, where great truths and mysteries are revealed, sometimes for the first time to close family. So I think hospitals are inherently places of great drama. So I think it's a perfect setting for a novel because you can get right to the action, so to speak, and right to the heart of what makes people tick.
She definitely does not want the EUS done today.
Does she understand what the implications of that are?
Yeah, she did, but, you know, I wanted to talk to her daughter. I got a page that her daughter's here.
Her daughter is there. Her daughter wants it, and she doesn't, so what do you do?
Holt's fiction takes place far away from hospital life, though one of his stories is about a plague that first makes an appearance on its victims in the form of a word. And in another, a man is so obsessed with the idea that he is dying that he ends up in a tomb from which there is no escape. It should not be surprising, says Holt, that he would explore ideas of death in his writing, since death is a reality that doctors deal with more than most.
I think it's true that death is the mother of beauty and an appreciation of human suffering and our limited on this earth is absolutely essential to seeing our lives and seeing the world we inhabit. And what makes me write is that I find this world an absolutely wonderful place, and the fact that mortality shows up as a ground to that is, I think, inevitable.
In a hospital, routine can quickly become a matter of life and death, and there's precious little time to sift through the events of the day to uncover what it all means. Perhaps then it's little wonder that some doctors would turn to that most contemplative of arts, writing, where they can be alone with their thoughts, searching for just the right words to find release or understanding. Lynn Neary, NPR News.
She's our 77-year-old African-American female with a past medical history of MI and 19.
If you're driving at the moment and you're using a GPS system for navigation, you can thank a small and somewhat secretive branch of the Pentagon. It's called the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA for short. Now, aside from the GPS system, DARPA has, over the past 50 years, brought us things like the internet, robotic arms, self-driving cars, and prototypes of supersonic spaceships. Now, for most of those years, DARPA's been off-limits to reporters, but Michael Belfiore managed to get in and write about the agency. His new book is called The Department of Mad Scientists, and Michael Belfiore joins me from New York. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
How did DARPA come about?
DARPA came about for the same reason that NASA did. In 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik, caused a great amount of consternation at the Defense Department as well as many other places in the United States, and was felt very strongly we have to do something. The Eisenhower administration ultimately had in mind a big, sprawling, well, what became a big bureaucracy, NASA. But they wanted to do something that would get into effect much faster. So they came out with ARPA, it was called at the time. Didn't have D for defense, but it's the same agency. The idea was to get a bunch of people in a room and get them cooking up ideas for defeating the Soviets in space. NASA came along and later in 58 took over the space mission. And so they moved into other areas such as information technology.
And eventually, as I mentioned earlier, scientists and researchers there went on to create what we now know as the internet and things like GPS.
That's right. They don't have any of their own laboratories. They just have people coming up with the ideas. These are PhDs, research scientists, as you mentioned, who just come up with the ideas. Then they go out into the field and they find people at universities, at private companies, who can actually put those ideas together.
I want to ask you about some of the gadgets and things you came across working on this book. Things like self-driving cars, do they work?
Self-driving cars do work. And this is a great success story for DARPA. The idea is they want to develop cars that can drive themselves through war zones so we don't have human drivers at risk. But this is part of what makes DARPA very interesting to me. They don't just own the technology after they create it. The institutions that they hire to do the work of creating things then have the right to go and develop these things on their own for the most part and to market them to the public. So DARPA sponsored 3 auto races that were driven by self-driving cars. And the latest one was in 2007. I watched these cars drive through city streets, stop at stop signs, signal their turns, stay within the speed limit. It's a very strange auto race. And these are starting to roll out these technologies in commercial vehicles, production vehicles. So you don't have to go all the way to fully autonomous to get benefits. You can have a car that can sense an impending collision and warn a driver of it, or perhaps even actually automatically swerve your vehicle away from a potential accident.
So the technology is there already.
It's absolutely there, yeah.
We've talked about things that are great and indispensable, but is there a dark side, in a sense, to some of the projects that have come out of DARPA or DARPA research?
Some of the work that DARPA is doing, I'm sure, is quite nasty. I was only allowed to see about half of what they do. So about 50%, I'm told, of what DARPA is doing is off limits to any outsider.
I mean, but we can assume that there are certain projects and weapons that they might be working on that could be incredibly effective and also destructive.
I've got just a glimpse of some of that. They're working on bullets that can guide themselves. So sort of missile technology compressed into the size of a bullet. So you just sort of fire your weapon in the general direction of where you want it to go, and it guides itself. They're also working on robotizing insects. So if you can implant very small electronics and control systems into insects, then you can use them as mini UAVs, mini unmanned vehicles.
The title of your book is The Department of Mad Scientists. So talk a little bit about the culture inside of DARPA.
I called the book The Department of Mad Scientists because they have a philosophy that unless something is so out there that a lot of people think it's impossible, it's probably not worth working on as a project. And when Tony Tether came in to DARPA, this was the director of DARPA who was there when I was writing the book. He's no longer there. But when he came in, his mission, as he saw it, was to keep this culture where people ran around, as he said, with their hair on fire, meaning that they were thinking so hard about so many extraordinary things that their hair, their brain overheated and their hair caught on fire. And there is a bit of that feeling there. Of course, literally, they're not running around, you know, cackling and you know, working with bubbling beakers of noxious smelling fumes. The idea is, though, that they are kind of hanging it out there. And this is a time, I think, that we're living in that's analogous to that time in the late 50s when we perceived this threat from the Soviets, this new threat from outer space. We're facing global warming. We're facing energy reserves that are controlled by hostile countries. And I think you need to really push the envelope to solve those things. And I think that DARPA exemplifies the kind of, you know, let's go for broke attitude that you don't see in a lot of places, and I think that we're going to need to see.
That's Michael Belfiore. He's the author of The Department of Mad Scientists, speaking with me from New York. Michael Belfiore, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It is finally publication day for Sarah Palin's much-hyped memoir, Going Rogue, and we have a review. It comes from Rod Dreher, a conservative columnist for the Dallas Morning News. He's the author of Crunchy Cons, which gets a brief mention in Palin's book. Here are his thoughts.
Sarah Palin is back to tell us that she loves Alaska and America and Todd, the first dude. She loves God, Ronald Reagan, cutting taxes, and serving those she calls ordinary, hardworking people. Who's on Sarah's enemies list? The media. Good old boys who condescend to her. Elites like the Alaskan gadfly she describes as a Birkenstock and granola Berkeley grad. Oh, and she really hates cynical McCain campaign staffers who, in her view, sabotaged her vice presidential campaign. That's pretty much everything you need to know about Going Rogue, the former Alaska governor's breezy new memoir. There's more about the intricacies of Alaskan politics than most readers could possibly care about. There are also familiar stories of life on the campaign trail, including plenty of petty score settling. But Going Rogue is a book designed to reintroduce Palin as a national political force and, though she's coy about this, to lay the groundwork for a 2012 presidential run. The rap on Palin is that she's too shallow and inexperienced for the presidency, a conclusion that early Palin supporters like me came to during the 2008 campaign. There's nothing in Going Rogue to challenge that conclusion. It's like this. Palin spends 7 pages dishing about her appearance on Saturday Night Live, but just over 1 page discussing her national security views. Palin positions herself as a populist, but her populism is entirely cultural. She fires the governor's mansion chef, who is bored because her kids won't eat his fancy-pants food. She swoons over a meal of homemade blueberry pie from hard-working, unpretentious, patriotic Alaskans. Unlike, one presumes, those uppity Berkeley snobs who prefer tarte tatin at Chez Panisse. A little of that goes a long way, and I wouldn't begrudge Palin a bit of it if her populism had any economic substance. Early in Going Rogue, she talks in detail about how Exxon exploited the people of Alaska in the Exxon Valdez disaster. And her experience tangling with oil companies taught Palin about how big business colludes with government to create a crony capitalism that harms the common good. And yet, she's incapable of understanding how the uncritically pro-business economic agenda she touts makes all this possible. In national politics, some feel that big business is always opposed to the little guy, she writes. Some people seem to think a profit motive is inherently greedy and evil, and that what's good for business is bad for people. That's what Karl Marx thought, too. Karl Marx? Well, say no more. Along these lines, Palin's economic program amounts to nothing more than tax cutting, deregulating, and the endless repetition of shop-worn GOP talking points. This is the Republican Party's great populist hope? She quotes her father's line upon her resignation this summer as Alaska's governor. Sarah's not retreating, she's reloading. On evidence of this book, Sarah Palin is charging towards 2012, shooting blanks.
Rod Dreher is a conservative columnist for the Dallas Morning News. As for Sarah Palin's future political aspirations, our senior Washington editor Ron Elving also has some thoughts on that. You'll find his column, Watching Washington, at npr.org.
And now for some headlines that could only come from The Onion.
Obama's home teleprompter malfunctions during family dinner.
NASCAR coach reveals winning strategy, drive fast.
Nation's gentrified neighborhoods threatened by aristocratization.
Postmaster General says letter carrier surge is working.
And now the satirical newspaper that modestly calls itself America's finest news source is out with a new book.
And two of the Onion editors joined us from New York, Joe Randazzo and Joe Garden. Welcome.
It's good to be here, Renee.
Yes, thank you.
There are several books of the Onion, right? But this is
Yes. Our
front pages. And those front pages really it hinges on the headline.
Absolutely. As a lot of people who have cornered us at parties have informed us, well, I only read the headlines anyway. We're pandering to the lowest common denominator with this with this one.
And on the other end of the spectrum, I think it's a book for the diehard fans who would never get to see a lot of these older covers as well. So we've got the erudite obsessive people and then the dumb people.
Right.
I think it would be fair to say one of the classic headlines was New Starbucks Opens in Restroom of Existing Starbucks. I'm
right.
Sorry, I can't even read it without laughing. Do you write the headlines first?
Yeah, no, everything really extends from the headline. You've got to be able to have a joke that gets its point across, but it all starts with 500 to 800 headlines that we get every week, and then we kind of cull those down and pick out the best of the best.
And then where do the headlines come from? That is your
The headlines come from long periods of desperation, boredom, and a fleeting panic that we have to get our assignment done in time for the Monday meeting.
Right. There's also angry, bitter observations of other people in life who you think have it better than you. There's things that annoy you. And then a lot of sitting around watching TV.
We live very rich lives.
We're all perfectly satisfied.
And you wonder if, you know, everything is sort of fodder or if you see a headline like guests forced to pretend wedding a good thing. And I'm thinking, who was at the wedding? And that's all they could think.
I've even talked to writers who've told me that it's an obsession that nearly everything that they see, think, or do gets instantly kind of reframed into this headline. So I think it is. It runs the gamut from big national absurdist events to, you know, your roommate eating the rest of your Hot Pockets or something.
Yes. It does have this huge swing. And there's ones in the middle like gay couple to add exciting big city feel to small town. It is sort of a little bit about your roommate or the guy down the street, but it's also sort of about big issues.
It's also sort of about some of us grew up in small towns. I grew up in a town of 5,000 in rural Wisconsin, and we channel that small town newspaper voice. And sometimes it is sort of like couching bigger issues in like a very sort of banal way.
Well, one headline that, you know, people talk about, and I'm actually curious, you know, how it came about. Several headlines that you had in The Onion that came out after September 11th.
Right. There's a terrorist surprise to find cells in hell. That was always that was actually one that I was against because I thought it was just too pandering, but it turned out to be a very cathartic one that people liked a lot.
But the issue did kind of run the gamut of hugging up 10,000%.
Sure, and not knowing what else to do, Woman Bakes American Flag Cake, which is a personal favorite.
God clarifies no killing rule.
Angrily clarifies. Sorry.
And I mean, U.S. vows to defeat whoever it is we're at war with.
Sure, sure.
But I'm wondering, do you have limits to your taste or your willingness to do tasteless things?
No, there's no topic that ever has come up that has been, oh, no, we can't touch that topic. But we are just as conscious of making sure that if we do try to tackle a topic that is a little more sensitive, that we're targeting the right people or the right entity, and that we're not just making jokes about horrible things with no context or no point or no heart.
You know, when you talk about the right side, the right side suggests some sort of political position or even a moral position. And what does that mean?
It's more about common sense to us,
right?
Or kind of pointing out hypocrisy or stupidity. And of course, we get to do it, you know, unanimously. So we don't have to share any of our own hypocrisies or stupidities with the world. But I don't think that anybody ever has a political axe to grind on the staff. I would not say that we are a group of Republicans, but I don't think that we're a group of really left-wing liberals either. You know, if we see something that you can look at and say, well, that's kind of stupid. They're acting kind of stupidly here. We should make a joke about that.
Well, in this last presidential election, you were pretty equal opportunity and found humor actually at that point when people were a little leery of trying to make jokes about Barack Obama.
Are you talking about a black man given the nation's worst job? was worst is paraphrasing, yeah. I believe. And then one of the other smaller stories was Nation finally shitty enough to make social progress, which is another really good one. Of course, we also had an issue prepared in case John McCain won, which had Nation elects first ever 44th white president and a maverick put in charge of world's largest nuclear arsenal. So that's actually in the book.
You do have one headline that says, factual error found on internet. error, singular, just to make sure people know. But I've heard that with the internet, some people see your fake stories and actually think they're real.
That happens a lot. Unfortunately, if you present something in a very real fashion, some people will just sort of accept it at face value. When you have a story like Congress threatens to relocate unless new Capitol building is built, which would, you know, retractable dome for daylight legislation and so on, and that was actually picked up by a Chinese newspaper and run. Just they translated it and ran it as actual fact, including the graphic that our graphics guys worked so hard on.
Now that actually I could see you being pretty gleeful about. I mean, you almost can't blame the Chinese. It's a little off, but they're another culture.
This is true.
You know, they positioned it as you see the debaucherous nature of even the American leaders, you know. And then when they finally learned that it was a satirical newspaper, I think they printed a response that was like, so you see, in America, they have newspapers that make money off of lies.
Right.
So it was quite an honor, actually.
Joe Randazzo and Joe Garden are editors at The Onion. They are two of the many editors of the new book, Our Front Pages, 21 Years of Greatness, Virtue, and Moral Rectitude from America's Finest News Source. Thank you both very much.
Oh, were we recording that whole time?
I thought this was a pre-interview.
And we have more headlines at npr.org, including a few at our expense.